That's another evening of question time. For those of you who missed question time after the end of the retreat, you can get your wife, your husband to ask you questions at 8 o'clock, at 8 o'clock every evening. See what happens. But here comes the first question this evening. The Ajahn at the time of death. Has anyone got any plans? Will the mind have enough clarity to observe the spaces between each moment of consciousness arising and ceasing? Probably not. If you can't do it now, how do you reckon you're going to do it when you die? So prepare yourself while there is still time. Don't leave it to the last minute. That's what sometimes people think, because it's true that your last thought moment is crucial to your rebirth. So what many people think, they say, I only have to look after the last thought moment. So I'm going to be a scallywag all my life and go and get drunk and go and visit the houses of ill repute, go and gamble, who cares? But make sure the last moment. Unfortunately, your last moment is not so amenable to such trickery. Your last moment is a sum total of everything which you've done in your life. So it's completely conditioned. So your last moment does not follow your will. What you think you'd like to do at the end is what you've been training to do now. That creates your last moment. So you can't get away with it that easy. You have to be a virtuous person now, and then you'll have virtuous thoughts when you die. If you are scallywag, if you are a naughty person, then when you die, that's what will come up. So, but to observe the spaces between the consciousness, that's really a difficult thing to do. You have to be very, very wise, because again, we really think we exist. And so we're not looking for that. We don't know where to look. So if you can do it now, maybe you can do it when you die. Does the observation of the space between each moment of consciousness play a significant role in uncovering non-self? Absolutely. Because you see that the continuity is broken. And it's a continuity which gives the illusion of a self. Just like, remember those, before you had these video cameras, and sometimes you used to have these reels of pictures. And I remember as a kid, you used to go to these seaside places, and you had these little machines, they're just cars, which you flipped over very quickly. And you could actually get the illusion of movement, of continuity of action, but it was just like still photographs which were moved very quickly. It's similar to consciousness. It's just a moment, many, many stills, which move so quickly they give the illusion of a continuity. And it's a continuity of the self which gives the illusion that I exist. You're continually changing. As the Buddha said, this mind rises as one thing and passes away another thing, continually, day by day, night by night. So it's never the same, one moment after the next. However, there's an illusion of continuity. And part of that illusion is because you don't really understand what the mind is. And I, many years ago, gave the fruit salad simile. And the fruit salad simile goes like this. Imagine you've got a plate in front of you. And there on the plate is an apple. And suddenly the apple disappears. And now there is the coconut. And the coconut suddenly disappears, and there's another apple. And the apple suddenly disappears, another coconut. And then there's a banana, and the banana disappears, and there's a coconut. And then a banana disappears, and there's a cauliflower. And the cauliflower disappears, and there's another banana, another coconut. There's all these different fruits, and as soon as one disappears, it's always followed by a coconut. And then another fruit, and then another coconut. In this simile, the apple stands for your eye, the banana stands for your nose. The cauliflower stands for your ear. I forget what else I said for apple, yeah. But the coconut stands for your mind. Because every time you have a sense experience, like you see something, immediately afterwards the mind jumps in and knows you've seen. And then you might smell something, but you notice. And then immediately afterwards you know you've smelt. The coconut appears. And then maybe you hear something, cauliflower ears. You hear something, and your mind jumps in and knows you've heard. So after every sense consciousness, there's always this mind. And because the mind follows afterwards, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, there's always something similar to those senses. There's always something which thinks is exactly the same. And what it is the mind consciousness follows immediately afterwards, which gives it the illusion of sameness. But once you know what this mind consciousness is, you understand what the coconut is. Because you got into a jhana, you know what the mind is, and you can see what happens. You see something, and then the mind comes in afterwards and knows you've seen. So this is actually what happens. And then you can understand how these six sense consciousnesses are completely different. Because the mind gets involved, it gives it the illusion of sameness, which supplies the delusion that there's a continuity of conscious experience, that we're always conscious. There's something always the same from moment to moment. But indeed, every moment of consciousness is completely different. That way, there's no person going across. If you understand that, then you're 99% of the way to being enlightened. But if you can't understand that, shut up, get into jhanas, and there's a good chance you might. Do you understand what the mind is? Any comments or questions about that, the fruit salad simile? Da-da-da. Okay, next one. If a person of a different faith follows the Eightfold Path, is it correct to say that she could be born in a celestial realm? Yeah, sure. You don't have to even follow the Eightfold Path to be born in a celestial realm. You just have to be a good person. It's virtue that you should become in a celestial realm. It doesn't matter if it's you're following the Eightfold Path, as long as you're a good, kind person. Then you get reborn in the celestial realms. I don't know, this is an old story. It's a long time since I told this. But this is the story about this Christian priest. It's a Christian story, but it's a really good one, but it involves Buddhism and involves a few other things. There, many, many, many years ago, a Christian priest was giving a sermon in church. And this sermon was all about the only way to get to heaven is to believe in Jesus Christ. And at the end of his sermon, somebody put their hand up and asked a question. Now, you can always ask a question in Buddhism, but you're not supposed to ask a question in church. And so that was a tough one. But the fellow who asked the question, he was very wealthy. And of course, you know, if you're a priest, or even a monk sometimes, you always look after the very wealthy donors. So he said, okay, sir, sort of, what's your question? And the fellow said, well, you just said, you know, you just told us, the only way to go to heaven is to believe in Jesus Christ. If you don't believe in Jesus Christ, you must go to hell. What about all these amazing, wonderful people in the world, like the Buddha? You know, like the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius, if you ever read his Meditations, he's an amazing person. What about people like Socrates? Very, very wise and very virtuous. What about people like Mahatma Gandhi? Do those people have to go to hell? Because they weren't Christians, for sure. Even Voltaire, I think he was the other guy in the story, a very sharp, wise person. What happened to those? And the priest was very quick. He said, not much time to answer now, I'll tell you next week. If you don't know the answer, always procrastinate. So, after giving the sermon on a Sunday, the Christian priests always take Monday off, because, you know, it's the only time they can have a day off. So he just forgot about it, enjoyed himself on Monday, and Tuesday he got his books out to try and find an answer, because he had to tell the answer the following Sunday. He looked through his books, and yeah, it's very hard, he couldn't get a good answer anywhere. So he rang up one of his mates, another sort of priest, and had a interview, had a session with him on Wednesday. He went to this priest, and the priest said, you know, it was more senior to him, he said, well, that's a very tough question, you have to go to the bishop. So he went to the bishop on Thursday, and the bishop said, oh, it's too big for me, the archbishop. So he went to the archbishop on sort of Friday, and the archbishop said, that's a question for the theologian, go and see him on a Saturday. So he went to see the theologian on Saturday, and the theologian actually gave him an answer, but he couldn't understand a word of it. And so he was stuck. Saturday night came. The following morning he'd have to sort of front up to this very wealthy donor and give a reasonable answer. And he worried himself sick all night, trying to figure out how he can answer this. Because it doesn't make sense. These are all really good people. They doesn't deserve to go to hell. There's no justice there. So he hardly slept all night. And he got up early in the morning, still having no answer. And he thought, the only thing I should do is go into the church early and pray for guidance. So he went into the church in front of the altar and started praying. And because he had slept all night, he fell fast asleep at the altar. And as he was asleep, he had this dream. You know, like you do sometimes when you oversleep or you sleep at the wrong time. A very clear and vivid dream. He was at a railway station. And in that dream, he knew sort of what was going to go on. Because he saw a train on one of the platforms. And he asked one of the railway guards, he said, "That train over there, it wouldn't be going to a place called heaven, would it?" And the guard said, "Yes, actually it is. And seeing as you've got your collar on, you're a religious person, you can go up there for free, no charge." So he got on the train, it's all in a dream, and in no time at all, the train pulled in another station. He could see on the side of the station the words H-E-A-V-E-N, he got to heaven. And so he got out of the train, you've heard this one before, haven't you? Heaven, oh, okay. He got out of the train, got outside, and, wanted to, check where he really was. So he went up to this person with this donut on top of his head, and there's a halo on top of his head, and sort of and white clothes. And the fellow came out and said, "Oh, welcome, my dear friend." He was very kind, very nice. But the priest said, "Could you please just confirm for me, where am I?" He said, "Oh, this is heaven, welcome. Do you want something to eat?" He said, no, not yet, but I want to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, how long have you been up here?" And this angel said, "I've been up here for thousands of years, a long time." And the priest said, "You're just the guy I want to talk to. Now, you've been up here so long, you must know most people." He said, "Oh yeah, of course, except the newcomers, I haven't really met them yet. But, do you know anyone up here by the name of Buddha?" And the angel said, "Buddha? Never heard of that name." "What about Socrates, this Greek guy?" "No." "What about Marcus Aurelius, this Italian fellow?" "No, Marcus Aurelius." "Mahatma Gandhi, a little black guy?" "No, never heard of him either." And the priest had his answer. He felt so self-satisfied in his dream. So he went back to the station, confident he could answer the rich person, sort of with his own experience. But as he was in the station, he noticed on another platform there was another train. And he also intuitively knew where the other train was going. And he asked the guard, he said, "That train over there wouldn't be going to a place called hell, would it?" And the guard said, "Yes." So he had a chance actually to find out if those guys were down there. So he bought himself a return ticket. Just in case, you can never be sure. And he got on the train, and after a short time, they came into this other platform, and there, sure, on the big sort of red letters with a few balloons on either side, was H-E-L-L. So they got out of the train, and this time he never needed to go and look for anybody. Someone came straight up to him, gave him a hug and said, "Oh, welcome to hell. Can we get you something to drink? How about something to eat? Please, let us know what you need." And they're even more friendly and more kind than they were up in heaven. He said, hang on a minute, you're very, very kind, but are you sure you don't want something to drink?" "Yeah, no, please. "Okay, what do you want to know?" he said. He said, "First of all, what's this place called?" "It's hell, welcome. Are you sure you don't want something to eat?" He said, "Look, I'll have something to eat later, but first of all, how long have you been up here?" "Ah, oh, thousands of years. You know, we've got some really nice pizza up in hell. Charboiled. Barbecued." Now he said, "Look, quick. You've been up for thousands of years. Now, do you know most people here?" "Oh yeah, we know everyone up here. We get on so well together. But do you know anyone down here called Buddha?" "Oh, the Buddha? Oh, such an amazing, wise, compassionate being. Oh, just, he's one of the best people down here. What about Socrates?" "Oh, he's just so sharp and wise." "So Marcus Aurelius? Oh, even though he was a soldier before, he's just so, so wise and discriminative. Voltaire, just really funny guy, but he's great. And Mahatma Gandhi, oh, he's just come down here recently. Everybody loves him." And the fellow had his answer. He said, "Look, this is really weird. because according to my religion, all these people should be down here. But this is supposed to be a place of suffering, a place of torment, a place of pain. And the fellow he met said, "Ah, yeah, it used to be like that before the Buddha came down here." Now, I'm not meaning the Buddha has gone to hell, because if the Buddha go anywhere, he's gone. But the moral of that story, that's a great little story, it's the people who make the place, it's not the place which make the people. So if good people did go down to hell, they'd make a wonderful place of it by now. And that's the main thing. Hell is not a physical place. You make your own hells, you make your own heavens. It's the people who make the place. So it doesn't matter what religion you are. If you're a good person, you make good places for yourself. And that's just why that, so as far as it going to heaven is concerned, no religion has got a franchise on heaven or hell. And no one sends you down there. You don't have to believe in this one or believe in that one. It's just goodness and wisdom. And that, when you understand you've got a bit of sense, that's common sense, it's obvious. So that's what happens. But to become enlightened, that's a different matter. To become fully enlightened is Eightfold Path. Doesn't matter what you call it. Doesn't matter if you think you're following the Bodhisattva path, Pure Land, Mahayana, Theravada, or whatever you think you're doing. If you're practicing that Eightfold Path, this is where it leads. Okay, any comments about that? I don't know. Okay, next question. Please teach us how to find the balance between being straightforward and gentle in speech and lots of metta. May you live long, well and happy life to teach many beings. Now that's not metta. Asking me to live a long life. Oh, you cruel beings. Okay. How to find the balance between being straightforward and gentle in speech. Okay, this is actually the advice which the Buddha gave to his monks. Before you admonish someone, in other words, you're straightforward. Number one, you should actually start to think, have I got my facts right? Because so often we admonish someone for something they haven't done. We just got it wrong. We didn't understand what they were doing it for or why they were doing it. We jump to too many conclusions. I don't know how many of you read that story in my book, but to prove that point many years ago, I made a confession. And this was actually the time, for those of you who don't remember this story, it was a time when as many monks were being very, very naughty, being fined with mistresses and having to disrobe. So at that time, at Nolamara Temple, one Friday evening, I took the microphone and made my confession that a few years earlier that I'd spent some of the happiest hours of my life in the arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged, we loved each other. And I remember when I first said that, everyone went so quiet. And a few people went for the door straight away. Oh no, not Ajahn Brahm. Because with another man's wife, that's adultery. Until I said, that man's wife was my mother. It was my father's wife. And I spent really the happiest hours of my life as a young baby in the arms of another man's wife. It was a nice little joke there. They got people because they heard it and they jumped to a conclusion. They got it wrong. I did it on purpose, obviously, you know, just the way I said it and the way you put it, you know, the arms of loving arms of another man's wife. It just sounds like adultery, doesn't it? You jump to a conclusion, but it's wrong. So the first thing, before you're going to be straightforward, is make sure you've got the facts right. Because too often in my life, and maybe your life as well, you've admonished someone, it's been really unfair, you just haven't understood what was going on. You've got the wrong end of the stick. And that happens too often. So, first of all, make sure you've got your facts right. Number two, make sure you haven't done anything just as bad, or even worse. Because if you admonish somebody else, you know, you're straightforward, and you're being a scallywag yourself. It's like you come in here and you say, you know, that the monks should be up here at, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning. They weren't here this morning. That's not good enough. But were you here this morning? If you've been here every morning, then fine. You've got the right to admonish somebody else if you really want to. But too often we admonish other people and we haven't sort of got our own act together yet. And so we're being hypocrites. So first of all, before you admonish anybody else, make sure that, you know, you are not doing similar things or worse things. So that's number two, before you're straightforward. Clean up your own act. Number three, if you're going to be straightforward, why are you being straightforward? Is it out of ill will, out of pride, out of jealousy, to get your own back, revenge or something? Or is it really out of kindness, loving kindness? Have you really got that other person's well-being at heart? So you have to really check that it's coming out of loving kindness, real care. And the next thing is, that is it the right time and place? Because you're not straightforward to someone that just come home from work after a busy day. And you say, husband, I'm going to talk to you. And the poor fellow, he's just had it up to here. And he's not going to listen to what you say. Which is why if you've got something to be straightforward, especially if it's to your partner, then the best thing to do is take them out to dinner. In a nice restaurant, you know, their favourite restaurant, and when it gets to the last course, you can ask them whatever they like. They're just so soft like butter, you can be straightforward and they'll take it. If you try it any other times, they'll hit you. So you've got to choose the right time and place. And it works, it's obvious, you know, you understand what I mean, in married life or anywhere else. You've got to find the right time and place. And I tell these monks, if they want to ask me anything, you know, any special favour, they want to go somewhere, do something. Now look at me, if I come back, you know, from Nolamara really tired, it's the last time to ask me. But look at me, I've just come out of a beautiful meditation. I've got a big smile on my face. They'll ask me anything and I always say yes. You know, you're so soft and, oh yeah, sure, whatever you want to do, go and do it. And that's like with the people you live with. Find the right time to ask them. And then ask them kindly. Not with sort of harshness. Because if you ask them kindly or tell them kindly, and it really is coming from loving kindness, they're much more likely to listen to you. Instead if you come, you stupid lazy pig, you know, this is what you've been doing. Straight away, they're not going to be listening to you. And say, you know, my dear wife, you know, I really love you, really kind, very nice, but if you don't mind me saying, but if you do mind me saying, let me know, but if you don't mind me saying. So you're over the top in kindness and people listen because that shows that you care about them. So that's what you have to do with straightforward. It's straightforward, but it's gentle and it works. If you just blast it out, but, you know, just go blast a person, you never get anywhere. That makes sense. That's how to be straightforward and gentle and wise in your speech. Usually what happens, by the time you've figured or considered all those things, the person's gone, so you shut up anyway. Having read your book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, and absorbing every single word carefully, I bet you haven't absorbed every word carefully, what's on page 128? I was only joking, sorry. Every single word carefully and clearly, I am still finding it difficult to block my ears, even though I am slightly deaf in one ear. The tiniest of sounds break my concentration, or is it my mind goes looking for obstacles? You've seen it. That's what happens. It's a strange thing, but actually you go looking for something to disturb yourself. It's weird. You know, why do you do that? It's because you don't want to be still. There's something you're afraid of. You don't want, you know, the sound to disappear. It's the same as sitting here quite happily and you wonder what's going on with my legs. You go looking for something to sort of cause yourself trouble. Or like somebody is peaceful at home, they've got nothing to do, they can really relax. What do? Go and turn on the TV. See what's there. Look in the fridge. See what they need to eat. Instead of just leaving alone, you weren't really hungry, you're just bored, looking for something to distract yourself. And I can't really believe why it is that people have got enough problems in their life already. And what do they go and do? They go and watch these soap operas like Neighbours or Home and Away so they can find out some more problems to worry about. And they really worry about these characters. And some of them they just have to watch and see what happened to Mrs. This or Mr. That. And they worry all day about in the next episode what's going to happen. My goodness, I mean, just you've got enough to worry about in life without having all these extra pieces of fantasy to care about. So just forget about those things. But actually, you go looking for sound to disturb yourself. It's a strange thing. You go out there to try and to hear something. Like the birds outside, or, you know, the sound of, I don't know, the rain or whatever. It's got nothing to do with you. Even like somebody starts talking. So they're in the room next to you. What happens? You go listening. What are they saying? It's none of your business. Forget it. I try hard to stay longer with the beautiful breath and sometimes get to an end just for a short while. Can you please help? Should I use some earplugs at least at the beginning? I have had a couple of successes also getting to the limiter. Good. No, just always remember, like, you know, I don't know if I told this story, it's one of my favourite stories. There's a Malaysian couple here in Australia. I better not tell you exactly who they are, because it's very, very embarrassing. They were sitting at home watching a movie, and once the movie had finished, they got up and go to the toilet, make a cup of tea or something. And as they got up and looked behind the sofa, there was many things missing from their room. The burglar had been into their house, and actually right behind the sofa, and taken this, that and the other, while they were busy watching the movie. Now, burglars are usually quiet, but you can't be perfectly quiet. But the thing is, they were just so absorbed in the movie. The burglar could have sort of taken the trousers off them and they would have noticed. Because that's what it's like when you're right in there and you can't hear anything and you can't feel anything because you're just watching to see what happens in the end. Now that's the sense of absorption which people can get, and they do experience that in life when they're really just watching the last over of the cricket match or the last 5 minutes of the soccer final. Whatever else it is, you get so absorbed you forget everything else in the whole world. You can't even hear anything. Now, that should give you the indication of what you need to do to be able to let go of sound. You need to be just so delighted and content in your meditation object, getting so much fun there, that it just drags you right in and holds you there. You're just having too much fun. It just fills up your whole mind and satisfies your whole mind. It's just enjoyable. So, if it's a beautiful breath, it's not beautiful enough yet. If it was more beautiful, you wouldn't hear the sound. It's nice, but not nice enough. So build up more joy and happiness. And you're just having such a wonderful time with this breath. It's better than a movie. Just watching it, oh, it's so nice. No, it's beautiful. Great. And you can't hear a sound. Because you're satisfied and the mind just will not go out looking for something else. The nature of the mind is always to search for happiness. You can't stop that. That's its nature. This is what it does. If it doesn't find happiness in the meditation, it will go finding happiness somewhere else. Usually in plans and memories, fantasies, dreams. Anywhere, just to give it something to do. So if you don't get happiness in your meditation, the meditation doesn't stay. Which is why happiness, born of contentment, is the key. You get to a certain stage of meditation, it's usually the beautiful breath, where the meditation is happy enough, you've got enough inner joy, you don't need to put any effort anymore. The snowball is rolling down the hill, and it gets more and more happiness, because the happiness just draws you in. You're just delighted, this is a great time, you don't have to do anything. And the rest of the world all disappears. Nice question, anyone, any comments about that? Next question, here we go. Dear Ajahn, not a question, just like to share a method I use to calm my mind with everyone. If my mind gets really disturbed, then I contemplate on all the great qualities of the Buddha. If it is really, really disturbed, then I think of all the Pali words at each quality and translate it. When doing this over and over again, the mind settles down and becomes very peaceful and soft. If you've got faith and you know the Pali words, that works. But if you don't know much Pali, and you know your faith is sort of okay, but you know not that great, then sometimes it doesn't work. But the reason why it's worked for that person is because by doing that, it gives them joy, they know exactly what they mean, and it fascinates them. So you're doing something which is fascinating, enjoyable, absorbing, which means everything else gets blocked out. That's why it works. I remember this other fellow years ago. He told me a very, very nice technique, which I haven't mentioned yet, because he could never manage to watch the breath. No way could he watch the breath when he was doing meditation. He tried and just couldn't find it. Or if he found it for a second, it disappeared. So this teacher of his, and he didn't tell me who it was, but it was a brilliant method. He said, well, when you close your eyes, when you settle down, present moment awareness or silence or whatever, when you settle down, don't try and watch the breath. Imagine you're watching the breath. Just imagine it, what it would be like to be able to watch the breath. So close your eyes and just imagine watching your breath. So he followed that technique. He just imagined watching the breath. Just, you know, fake it. Imagine it. And after, you know, 1 or 2 minutes, the teacher interrupted him and said, what are you watching? He said, the breath. He was watching the breath because imagination is just so close to reality when you get into the realm of the mind. If you imagine it, it's like it's being there. That's why if you get to a certain state of meditation, if you just imagine a nimitta, it's just hardly any distance to a real nimitta, because you've made it in your mind. It's amazing the power of imagination, and then you create reality afterwards. Any questions about that one? Going, gone. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what time does the retreat finish on Sunday? Oh, it's only Friday. I have an announcement. It doesn't finish on Sunday. You're going to be here forever. I'll answer that question on Sunday. Now, some of you want to know. We'll find out maybe tomorrow morning. I'll make that announcement. Please explain the difference between watching the nimitta and holding it too tight. Please kindly suggest some strategies. The simile of putting down the glass of water does not work while I'm in the middle of it. In the middle of the glass of water, yeah. Now, usually what happens, it's true, because when you're in the middle of things, you can't do anything. It's too late then. It's like sort of a tennis player. When they're actually on the court in the middle of a match, they can't decide what to do. It's all automatic. They have to respond so quickly that they've either got it or they haven't got it. But what they do, if their coach sees that they've got a fault in their play, then they take them, when they're not actually playing a match, they take them to the practice court and they practice that forehand again and again and again outside of the match. So if you see you've got some difficulty, say in the nimitta stage, of being able to, you know, you're holding it too tight, or you know, if you don't hold it at all, it just disappears. Then you've got to learn outside of the meditation, or outside of that particular place, because that place is too subtle to do anything. What you do, beginning of the meditation, you program your mindfulness, you give yourself the instructions. If that happens, then instead of watching the nimitta, I'll watch the one who's watching and keep that still. Or you can try the instruction, Ajahn Chah, still forest pool. Beautiful animal coming out, I'll be like Ajahn Chah, I'll be like still, like I'm watching an animal come out to play. And you give yourself that instruction at the beginning of the meditation. Because if you try giving those instructions when a nimitta comes out, the whole thing just shatters and it just disappears. But if you give yourself that instruction at the beginning, when a nimitta comes out, you're just about to hold it too tight. And that program kicks in. And it's subverbal. You don't even think about it, just like sort of the tennis player. It's natural, it's just what they do because they've programmed that in by training. And it just automatically happens. You just watch the knower. Keep it still. Or straight away the image of an Ajahn Chah by a forest pool. And you just hold it. And you find it works then. Because at that stage it has to be subverbal. You can't think. If you think, it just disturbs everything. It's the same way just like getting the nimitta to go into a jhana. If you do anything then, you just disturb it. This is far too subtle to do anything. But if you train yourself, give those suggestions. It's why, one of the main reasons why I gave that talk a couple of days ago is because one of these days you're going to get close. And now you've heard those instructions. Those instructions are in your mind now. You have been brainwashed. And when that moment comes up, the mind will know what to do. Because I've told you. And that will just tip you into the jhanas. So this is actually why those instructions are very powerful. At the right time, they will bear fruit. Simply because you've been told, the mind knows, and you know exactly what to do. Automatically. And so that's actually what you do. Don't try and interfere. When you get to that state, either it works or it doesn't work. And nothing much you can do about it. But train yourself, you'll find. Well, after you come out of the meditation, okay, you've made that mistake. Next time you're meditating, you think it's going to be a good one, you're going to get to that point in meditation. The very beginning, give yourself the instructions. This is what I'll do if this happens. Leave it. When you get to that stage, it'll be automatic. That's so helpful, that instruction. Okay, that's that one there. Next question here. Can a person with a developed mind predict the future birthplace of another human being? Can you predict the future of the birthplace of another human being? Not really, because you can see what the inclination is. Maybe I can predict the birthplace of Mr. Bush. But not necessarily, because he might change, because he's still got a few years of life yet, and who knows what a person can change. You can try predicting the rebirth of Angulimala. And before he met the Buddha, everyone would have said, that's a hell rebirth. I mean, after all the people he's killed, then he met the Buddha completely changed. So, how can you predict a person's rebirth? Maybe just at the end of their death, maybe you might be able to get some indications. But while there's still life, there is still hope, even for you. So that's why we don't do many predictions. And many people, they love predictions. They look at the horoscopes, and they try to go to fortune tellers, and they go to people, and they pay good money. And how many of you have been to a fortune teller and tried to get your fortune told? You crazy people. You're supposed to be intelligent. Before you go to a fortune teller, you should see if they've got Rolex watch, to see if they drive a good car and live in a big mansion. Because if they don't, it's a waste of time going to them. If they can't tell their own fortune, how on earth can they tell yours? If they can't predict the lottery numbers or the stock market, they're a waste of time. So never trust a poor fortune teller, is my motto. But remember once one of the stories. Good monks never tell fortunes. Except only once. Only once did Ajahn Chah tell somebody's fortune. Because there was one of these disciples of his who had really been helping him. When Ajahn Chah first went to the forest where he built his monastery, this man was there for him. Bought some stuff for building huts. Would actually feed him when no one else knew who Ajahn Chah was. And would sometimes take time off his business to go and drive him around. He was one of his supporters from the very beginning. It's like many of you have like supported the monks for so many years. And so this man came up to Ajahn Chah and said, please read the lines on my palm and tell my fortune. I know that you know. You know, you're a great monk. You should be able to tell me. So, Ajahn Chah said, no, good monks don't do that. We don't tell fortunes. And he said, but you gave a talk last week about gratitude, of how that people have helped us, we should help them back. And I've helped you so much. This is a little thing I ask, just to tell my fortune. Read the lines on my palm. Think of all the hours I've spent away from my family and business, all the food which I've given you, all the money I've donated. This is a little bit. You'll be a hypocrite. You say gratitude, and you won't even read the lines on my palm. And so Ajahn said, okay, give me your hand. And the man was really excited, because it's the only time that Ajahn Chah had read anybody's fortune. And he knew that Ajahn Chah would never tell a lie. And whatever Ajahn Chah said, it must work. So you're about to have your fortune told by someone you could trust. who had to work, because it was Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Chah took this man's palm, and with his finger, he started tracing the lines of his palm with full concentration. And as he was studying the lines, every now and again Ajahn Chah would pause and say, "That's interesting. Oh dear. Oh, that, wow, look at that." And he was winding this man up something awful. This poor man was getting more and more excited and couldn't wait for Ajahn Chah to give him his hand back. And when he did, he said, "What's my fortune? What's my fortune? What's going to happen?" And Ajahn Chah said, "What I say is true. I will not make a mistake. Yes, we know that, but tell us, get on with it. What's my future going to be?" And Ajahn Chah said, "Sir, your future is uncertain." And he wasn't wrong. That's the only time Ajahn Chah told the future. So that's the answer to your question. The future is uncertain. So now you too can predict the future. Future? Uncertain. You'll either get better or you'll die. Yes. The psychic powers want me to tell you the future. People say they have psychic powers, but a lot of times it doesn't work. There's a good example of that, and this is no joke, this is a real story. There's one of the monks I grew up with. You know, he was an American monk. And so I sat next to him for years. And so, you know, we always used to chat to each other and talk. And he said that twice he had these dreams, which turned out to be true. The first time he'd had a constant dream of his younger sister drowning in the family pool. They came from Pasadena, a really nice house. His father was quite wealthy. And he was, as a young man, he was sitting by the pool one day, just doing nothing. And the dream started to replay. And because he knew that dream, because it occurred so many times, he actually intervened and he saved his sister's life. And if he hadn't had that dream, he said his sister would have drowned. And that was actually a prophetic dream which actually came true. And then, a short time later, he was in New Zealand. And being a young man in that time, he was in a house with all the young men that were taking marijuana. And he dreamt that the police came to the house and caught them. And he kicked himself. He never took any action on that dream because it happened and he got deported. But the third dream, he said, the third dream was just as clear. He said that he knew he was going to die by being chased across the paddy fields of Vietnam by the Viet Cong. Because after the Vietnam War, many people thought that the communists would actually invade Thailand, and we were right close to the border. And he kept on saying, "I know I'm going to die that way because I've dreamt about it so many times." And these other two dreams had come true. But he never died that way. The communists never invaded Thailand. After 4 years as a monk, he disrobed. 1 year later, he was married. 1 year later, he was killed in a head-on collision. It wasn't true. So that's the trouble with dreams. Sometimes they're right, but sometimes we just get them wrong. So the psychic powers are very uncertain. And like as a Sri Lankan, you know, one of the stories of one of the bright lights of Sri Lanka a long time ago, who was a great Buddhist, was Professor Jatileki. He wrote many books. But he died in his mid-40s. And the reason he died was because he believed in a fortune teller. It killed him. Because this is what the story was. As a young student, he went to one of these fortune tellers, I think just in Tamil Nadu somewhere, had a big reputation. He just was a student, just to see, like most people do, just a bit of fun and games. Nothing to do that day. Let's go and get our fortunes told. And this fortune teller looked at this young man and said, "You're going to marry a lady by the name of blah blah." And, you know, the Sri Lankan names are very, very long. And later he met this girl, fell in love and married her. And it was this, one of these predictions which you just could not sort of do by coincidence. And he was so convinced from that time that this fortune teller was for real, that he would go every year to get his fortune told. And one time the fortune teller told him, you're going to live to an old age. And he believed that so much that in his early 40s he got sick, but he never bothered to see the doctor. He was going to live to an old age. And because he believed the fortune teller, one of his close friends told me this, because he believed in the fortune teller, he never took preventative action until it was too late. And he died in his mid-40s. So be careful. Sometimes fortune tellers can be so impressive. Psychic powers can seem so magical, but they are uncertain. Sometimes they hit the nail on the head, sometimes they don't. So be careful. There's another story which I read about this person who was in contact with one of these mediums. And the medium told him, go to the casino. I'm going to make you rich. He heard that very clearly. He said, I don't believe it. And the spirit said, go to the casino, I'll make you rich. So he went to the casino. He said, go to the roulette table. So he went to the roulette table. He heard it very clearly, go to the roulette table. Put $10 on number 16. So he put $10 on number 16. It won. Put all the winnings on number 23, he heard. So he put all the winnings on number 23. That came up too. Put all the winnings on number 10. So he put all the winnings on number 10. But it came up number 12, and he heard the spirit say, shit. So even the spirits get it wrong sometimes. You can't trust anyone in this world. You haven't heard that joke before, have you? Ah, I've got a new joke which you haven't heard. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, the next one is, what is the difference between nimitta and a delusive state? I don't know actually what you mean by that question. I mean, if you're like imagining a nimitta, if it's not really real. Usually, that if it's not really real, it doesn't develop, it doesn't go into like a brilliant, beautiful light, and it doesn't sort of suppress all of the five senses. So if it's not a real nimitta, this won't work. But give it a try. It might be the real one. If it's a real one, you'll be able to focus on it. It becomes very beautiful, very nice, and stays a long time. That's all I can answer on that one. Could you please explain to us what are the qualities of a good, genuine monk so we can support them? I heard all monks in my monastery and in the nun's monastery. They're all good monks. I heard in a monastery a monk say, white rice is not worth 5 cents, chuck it out. They also believe that they deserve the best. Is this the right attitude for a monk? When we face these, what should we do? First of all, like, be a bit sort of gentle and kind and not so fault-finding, because all monks, when they first become monks, they've got their defilements. They don't just put on the robe and become arahats straight away. So just like keep it not so fault-finding, a bit of compassion, as long as they are practicing and they're getting better. And you can see a monastery that people come in rough on the edges, and you can see that as they get training in this monastery, they get better and better, better and better monks. If you see them get worse and worse, then there's something going wrong there. So as long as you can see something happening there, some training being done, and see people at the end of their training, or at least, you know, as you go up the seniority line, getting better and better, then that should give you faith. If you just look at the young monks at the end of the line, the ones who've just come in, of course they'll be rough around the edges. You know, just like you would be if you just became a monk. So again, be discriminative but not fault-finding. And basically, in the end, look at the senior monks. If the senior monks are really messing around and not doing the job, then of course there's no hope for the junior monks. So really, it is up to the senior monks, you know, the leaders, to do the inspiration. And then, if you see the senior monks being inspiring, that's a good monastery to support. Because you know that they're sort of bringing the junior monks into line, slowly, and they get much better after a time. I think I said the other night, I've been very, very inspired. Because sometimes you see in the monks who are just hopeless. You think they'll never be able to manage it. And they pull through and they become great monks. It's wonderful to be able to see that. So it's a nice, just started thinking of a nice story of you know, some monk who really had a hard, well, actually many monks had a hard time when they were very, very young. But they all eventually become good monks if they stay the course, because the Eightfold Path works.
And also the fact that the lay people
could
get better than
their good monks. Yeah, the lay people getting better as well. But sometimes, you know, there are such things as bad monks as well. And so if you do see really, really bad monks, then it's best, you know, not to support them. Simply because the really bad monk, I'm talking about the really bad monks, is to spend all their time watching TV or, you know, just, you know, counting their money. And they, you know, they don't actually inspire like the ideal of a renunciant. But don't be so critical. But at the same time, there are some monks who just don't deserve support. I must admit, they're really lazy, and sometimes you wonder just, you know, that they should be supporting us. They're so rich, not the other way around. Some monks are very, very wealthy. So there's something wrong there. Does that make any sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah, good. So be discriminative. But the best place is not actually to support a monk, but support a monastery. Because that way you're supporting a tradition rather than an individual. If you find that monastery is actually working well, a nun's monastery, training all these people, giving the opportunity for nuns to actually live the religious life, you see a good monk's monastery training more monks or whatever. Those are things worthy of support. So whatever you give any donations, never give it to an individual. Don't give it to a monk. Give it to the temple. It's much better. Okay?
Sometimes the poor monks have to look after their parents, not in them.
Oh, that's usually not really the case. Because usually most of the parents, they've got many children. And sometimes that's not really the case. If they really are, then they should just get a fund for their parents, but they shouldn't touch it, it shouldn't be them. That's not the job of a monk there. The monk should be actually looking after their religious life. And many, I'm talking about Sri Lanka, it doesn't happen in Thailand, because Thailand's a pretty wealthy country now. I don't know about Sri Lanka, but maybe there might be some parents in a very, very poor village. But they usually survive. And the best thing is, you know, if the monk really has a very, very poor parent, they should just get a fund together just for that parent. Tell the disciples, and then the money never goes to the monk. Just gets straight to the parent. Ajahn, from what you said yesterday, do children choose their parents? Or whatever it is. Is this in sutta or your personal view? It's not in the sutta, but sometimes there's an attraction. It's not really a choice, but it's like, you know, you feel attracted to that person because there's some karmic link there. So it's not that you actually choose, but you get attracted to a certain person because they may have been, you know, your sister in a past life or a wife or something. And you just want to be with them again. So it's not actually choosing. But it's, you know, an attraction. Alright? Otherwise, some of you think, my goodness, why did I choose my dad or my mum? That was a bit of a mistake. Rather, you think, oh, a nice choice. What time is finish on Sunday, please? You can all go home once you've got first jhana. If you haven't got first jhana, no, go home. Wouldn't that be nice? Ajahn, in some religion, women should not enter the temples or perform some rituals at ceremonies when they are menstruating. Are there similar restrictions in Buddhism? Not at all. Because even like in the time of the Buddhas, all these arahat ladies, and they were in the temple all the time. All the days of the week. In fact, if the women weren't in the Buddhist temples, no one would be cooking for the monks and cleaning. So out of practical, most of the people actually support the monks or the women. Not always the case, but you know, they do the sort of majority of the cooking for the monks. And so out of practical concerns, if the Buddha restricted that, then there wouldn't be many women coming. So the point is, no, there's no such restrictions at all. I think that actually comes, is it coming from Hinduism, they have that? Yeah, there's nothing of that at all in Buddhism. What's the big deal? You know, sort of sometimes, you know, men don't menstruate, but certainly your nose runs. So what's the difference there? It's just, you know, gut oozing out of your body. So you have a rule there. Whenever you've got a runny nose, you can't go to the temple if you're a man. Make it fair. Okay, we answered that one. Next question. Why are the monks always served food before the nuns? This is just a tradition that arose from a patriarchal society, or is there some deeper meaning behind this? Now, I think it's just because that I am senior to any of the nuns over here, so the senior ones get it first. And if we actually split up, you know, monk, nun, nun, monk, sometimes people, it's very hard to actually know who's who. Because actually, that we look exactly, when you shave your hair, we look exactly the same. And actually, it's one of the reasons we made sure that here that the nuns wear a darker brown. This is a lighter brown which Sister Atapi has, and that sometimes can get confused with the monk. And it did actually happen many years ago at our temple in Nolamara. Just after lunch, we had a sister visiting us. I think, what was it? Sister Jatindria, I think it was. Jatindria. And she was visiting, one of the first nuns who actually, Western nuns who was actually visiting Perth. And after having lunch with us, then she went somewhere and somebody was driving her around. So she was in the front seat of a car next to a lady. And one of the Thai girls came out. They looked through the window. And because her robe was very similar to my robe, and I was there that day, she said, Ajahn Brahm is going off with a girl. Look. And she shouted out to everybody, Ajahn Brahm is going off with a girl. But I was very lucky because I just came out of the building at that time and said, where am I going? Ajahn Brahm. And if I hadn't come out there, she'd have been convinced that I'd have gone off in a car with somebody else because, you know, bald head, brown robe. Sometimes from a distance you don't know what's what. And, you know, people have, you know, I wouldn't have been able to help myself. You know, they would have said, I saw it, I saw you. And I was very fortunate I came out there because otherwise that people would have, you know, accused me of all sorts of shenanigans. So, you know, from that time on, that was almost like a wake-up call. If you're going to have nuns, have them some separation, especially different coloured robes. Otherwise you get into a big trouble because, you know, you are a celibate, but we have rules which are similar. I can't be alone with a woman, they can't be alone with a man. But, you know, if you see, like, you know, a brownie alone with a woman, is that a monk or is it a nun? So because there's a lot of similarity there, sometimes you have to have some sort of separation. So that's what we do here. Okay, next question. This morning you said that imagination was very close to reality. Did I say that? Or did you imagine I said that? Will you please explain this a little more? And how did you come to this insight? I imagined it. That's true, isn't it? Like, because what happens, what actually exists in the world, it forms a mental image. And that's what imagination is. Imagining. Imaging. And what's the difference between what's mind-created and the real world? When it gets to the mind world, so much of it is actually what we add onto it. And understanding that, we can actually work with these perceptions. And one of the things you can imagine, which I've been trying to encourage you all week, is imagine the happiness. Imagine the happiness with the breath. Develop that perception of happiness and joy. And is it real? Who cares? It works. It leads to jhanas and nibbana. So you develop that perception. When you're angry, you're imagining that as well. You're creating that. You're making that the image in your mind through which you look at the whole of the world through ill will. Understand the power of the mind. When you understand the power, you can make use of it to your advantage. I know that imagination has got a really bad name in our society because people don't understand how it can be well used. It's not just an escape from reality. what people call reality is mostly imagined anyway. It's just that particular framework which they use to see the world. So when you can actually change your frameworks to suit, you can look at anything and give it a positive spin, which is not real, but it's helpful. That's why the first factor of the Eightfold Path is right view. Is it really right view? Is it just one possible view amongst many others, one framework? The reason why it's called right view is not because it's more right than other views. It's because it leads you out of samsara. It leads to jhanas and to the end of things. That's why it's right. Okay, next question. Can you please explain how one experience anatta, non-self? When you know that you are not the body, you are a much bigger being. Is that enough for the time being? Yeah, realize you're not your body, but the only time you really are sure of that is when the doctor tells you you've got a cancer. It's terminal. And then you don't bother about it. So, okay, fair enough. And it doesn't affect you one way or the other. Then you know you're not your body. Or when you get a telephone call, when you go back to say your mother has died, and you say, I expected that. If you can do that, then you know these beings are not bodies. So you're not attached to these bodies, they don't affect you at all. You know that it's just a body, that's all, big deal. But how many of you can do that? Or how many people think your mother is that body? When it dies, you think your mother's gone. Well, it hasn't gone. She wasn't a body, she wasn't there to begin with. You've actually imagined that mother. Is it real? What's the difference between reality and imagination? It's a great question because you can really get deep into that and just see how much you add onto this world. So, that way that you know you've dropped the body, that when it dies or someone else's body dies and it doesn't affect you. However, that's only a fraction of non-self. It's when, I say, the five senses disappear or the mind stops. That's when you can really find out if you're really attached to a sense of self, like I said this morning. So, see if you can disappear. Remember what Ajahn Chah said, why? There is nothing. So there's nothing. There's no body, no mind. If you really saw that, then why are you trying? Why are you trying to get jhana so much? Who's trying to get jhana? Maybe let it all go. Don't even try anything. Let it be. Then jhana happens. The path is when no traveller on it is seen. Next question. Dajan, if you want to enlighten this life but didn't quite make it, and at the dying moment if you have all the good karma, then what is a good destination to be in order to keep walking in the path of enlightenment? Now, it's like, this is the same question as, what are we going to do on Sunday? What time are we going to finish the retreat? In fact, the other question is actually more sensible, because the retreat is certainly going to end on Sunday sometimes, but you're not going to die before Sunday. But if you didn't quite make it the dying moment, just try and be as peaceful as you can, as kind as you can, and just see where you end up. So this is all you can ever do, just be as peaceful as you can. Actually, I think it was Venerable Jnana Wimala, a great German monk in Sri Lanka. He once said, it's a nice, wise piece of advice, if at the end of the day, and I'm not meaning the metaphorical end of the day, which politicians keep saying, but just before you go to bed, you look back upon your day and you've done the best you possibly can, what more could you do? You can go to bed content. If you've done the very best you could possibly do in the circumstances, then you should be so content when you go to sleep at night. Doesn't matter if you're enlightened or got jhana yet. You've done the very best you could have done. Ah, wonderful, well done. That's called contentment. So you don't look at getting jhanas or getting enlightened or getting the last rebirth. You do the best you can. And that's all you can do. And that's the path to contentment. Make sense? I thought that was a really great piece of advice. Ajahn, how do you know when you are a stream winner after an experience, or how do you recognize an arahat or arahata? That's coming tomorrow in the talk on enlightenment. But certainly you can tell when they're not an arahat. If they say, I'm an arahat, look at me, I'm enlightened, wow, then you know they're certainly not an arahat. Because they won't go around telling people. Because one of those sayings is that anyone, so no, this was the advice of somebody said, if you do become enlightened, never tell anybody. If you tell someone once you're enlightened, you have to spend the rest of your life proving it. Because they'll always be testing you. If you come along here and just at the end of the retreat and say, hi guys, I just want to let you know I'm enlightened, you'll be looking at them and saying, trying to find fault with them. And say, yeah, you just pick your nose, I saw you, you can't be enlightened. Or whatever else it is. So just, why do you want to tell anybody anyway? Just keep it quiet. So if they say they're enlightened, then they're not. As we say, he who knows doesn't say. He who says doesn't know. Whoever said that obviously didn't know. When one does not feel the breath, if strong breath should not be taken, then should we imagine the breath? Please explain. If you can't feel the breath, leave it alone. What are you aware of? Ask yourself, what am I aware of right now? You must be aware of something, otherwise you're dead. So you're aware of something. What are you aware of when the breath is gone? So that's good enough for now. Just be in the present moment, be still. The mindfulness will build up in the stillness. So you don't need to go looking for things. What have you got right now? That's all you look for. So if the breath disappears, what's here? What am I aware of? So be present moment, be still. So be silent, I mean. And then you'll find the mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, so you can see more. And if the breath has disappeared, you'll see limiters. If it hasn't disappeared, you'll actually see the breath. Your mindfulness needs to be built up, not by doing things, but by more stillness. Make sense? Okay. Could you please explain casino meditation? It's when you go to Burswood. Oh no, casino. Casino meditation. Casino meditation is different than going to the casino. That is where you take a disc, a light, no, it's a picture, usually a circle of white, blue, red, or whatever colour you like. They only have a few colours in the party, but you can have any colour you like. You put that disc in front of you and you can look at it, close your eyes, and you can keep the image in your mind. If you can't keep the image in the mind, you open your eyes again, stare at it, and close it until you get that image. So you can hold the image of that disc, that coloured disc, in your mind's eye. I mean, really hold it there for long periods of time. I mean, if that's doing, what's actually you're doing there, you're letting go of all the other senses, and you're just keeping just an echo of the sense of sight. And that eventually turns into a nimitta quite quickly, but that's a tough meditation to do properly. Because you need a lot of stillness and you'll be able to hold on to an object for a long period of time. If you can't hold on to the breath without thinking of this or getting distracted, you're not going to be able to watch a disc for all that long without getting distracted. It's just a way of focusing. So it is one of the meditations, but it's not a popular one because it's just sometimes just too hard. Okay, anyone questions about that one? Da-da-da. Hajan, with the Eightfold Path, the word right is used to describe the different aspects, i.e. right view, understanding. Is the word right an accurate translation? Or is there a better translation that can be used? Thanks. I think I've already given the hint there that it's right in the sense that it fits the goal of freedom, enlightenment. So it's a path, and it's right because it goes in the direction of enlightenment, nibbana. So it's almost like perfect, it fits, it's fitting to the goal of liberation from suffering. That's why it's called the right path to end suffering. So there's no sort of actually absolute right and wrong. It's right because this is where it leads. It's a wrong path if you want to go to heaven because it leads beyond heaven. Does that make sense? It's right in the context of its goal. Its destination. In other words, It's right for those people who want to end suffering. Dear Ajahn, can animals get into high states of mind such as jhana and beyond? Gee, that's a tough question. I must admit that sometimes I've seen dogs sitting very quiet for many hours. And Ajahn Chah said chickens can sit on their eggs for days. But I don't know if they... And actually the chickens can levitate as well. I've seen chickens levitating. But I don't think that's a psychic power. Can the animals get into jhanas? I said, I don't know that. I never thought about that. I think it's obviously very, very, very rare, but gee, I don't know. Maybe they can. Who knows? I'm just thinking, is there any sort of examples of that anywhere? I mean, usually sort of, it'd be very, very, very rare. I think so. I think it's unlikely. But I just think, is there any reason why not? I don't know. Just think you stumped me there. No, it doesn't say the human beings are the only ones to get enlightened. David's getting enlightened as well. Not the animals, no, but I think that some of the animal realm, they're very, very alert, they're very intelligent. So, I don't know, it's an interesting question. Ajahn, you said in your morning talk in a story that people didn't like you flying in a plane. Why is that? It's not that they don't mind me flying in a plane. It's just, you know, that obviously that sometimes people are a little bit selfish in the sense that they sometimes say, don't sort of go travelling so far, stay with us so you can take a rest. And stay with us taking a rest means give more talks and more retreats in Perth. Because I've got all these invitations. You know, there's one lady in Sri Lanka who said, I've got a nice house in Sri Lanka, why don't you come in here and take a rest? And I know, big joke, I wouldn't take a rest there. They'll be asking me questions all day. So what they're saying is like, don't go to all these other places, come to us. So, and this is my main duty is with my monks in Serpentine. So that's my main duty, so I have to look at that first of all. And the other duties is obviously for the people in Perth, because you know, this is where my main duties are, responsibilities are. So I can't go travelling around too much. And that's the reason why people in Perth say, you're travelling around too much, you abandon us too much. And that's, you know, that's a good point to that. So that's why that when you say, come to Sydney and teach a retreat in Sydney. Why didn't you come to Melbourne and teach a retreat there? Why didn't you come and spend more time in Sri Lanka? They really need monks like you in Sri Lanka. But you should go to Thailand because, you know, there's people will really go to your talks in Thailand. Why didn't you go to England because, you know, your mother lives in England. You should do retreats over there. And so that point is that, you know, you can't go everywhere. And so because of that, sometimes people always complain. That's the only reason, because sometimes that you go away too much. It's only levitating. Now, can you become enlightened? Can cockroach become enlightened? I don't know. Yeah, sorry?
Flying,
yeah, he's learned how to levitate now. What is meant by the four pairs of the eight kinds of noble beings? Okay, that's very easy. The four pairs, the stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats, and those on the path and those who've got there. That's the four pairs. But that will come up tomorrow as well in the enlightenment talk. Ajahn, this is a silent retreat, but what is right speech? When is speech skillful or unskillful? For example, is gossip about the Sangha skillful? If I hear it, that'd be nice to know. No, it's skillful. When you're on a retreat, it's none of your business. So just keep it quiet. No need to gossip about the Sangha or gossip about anybody. So, on a retreat, that noble silence, and this is really important. I never gave this instruction, but usually the instruction is, if you think you need to say something, say it because it's about the kitchen or someone's not closing the toilet door or whatever, then if you think it's important, first of all, before you open your mouth and speak, say, is this really important? Check that first of all. That's number, checklist number one. Is it really important? And if you pass that first test, yeah, it really is important. Then the second thing you have to ask yourself, is it really, really important? And if it passes that checklist here, I mean, it really, really is important. Then the last checklist, is it really, really, really important? And if, you know, the third tick goes in the box, yes, it really, really, really is important, then you can speak. But usually by that time the person's gone anyway, so you don't need to speak. So in other words, most of the stuff which you say during a retreat such as this is unimportant. And you just do it out of habit. So keep quiet. No need to speak. And you find you get into deep meditation when you're quieter. Because you're restraining the external speech, the inner speech also gets restrained. And that way, you get better meditation. Remember, if someone speaks to you, it could be your partner, your husband, your wife. In this retreat, you're allowed to put your hand in front of your mouth and say, shh. Or if it is your wife, you can put your hand on her mouth. In other words, you know, you just tell them, shh, this is retreat time. You don't need to speak. If necessary, you can just write messages to each other. Because messages are really good, because you can use them in evidence afterwards. Blessed art thou amongst women, eh? Blessed in the fruit of the wounds of Jesus. Actually, what does this mean? Blessed art thou amongst women, blessed in the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Ajahn, does this same meaning apply when we chant it with the word blessed for Bhagavat? I don't know that. Does that come from Christianity? That's Hail Mary. Blessed art thou amongst women. Oh, I mean, like Mary is blessed. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb. Oh, Jesus, I get the message now. Yeah. But I thought it's a virgin birth. Oh, that's right. It still came from. Actually, yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So I don't know too much about Christianity these days, except what I read from Da Vinci Code that Jesus got married to Mary Magdalene. But maybe that's not quite right. Blessed are thou amongst women. Blessed the fruit. It does the same meaning apply when we charge it the word blessed for Bhagavan? Not really. No, I don't think that really fits. Because blessed, well, yeah, it's wrong, because blessed over here is even the word homage to the blessed one, even that is not really quite right, because it's, you know, using a Christian term. Blessed means, I think, you're anointed actually by God. So Bhagavat just means like a lord or like a high being. It is not a very good translation. But sometimes when you're translating these Indian terms into English, because most of the vocabulary in English is based on Christianity, and so it's very hard to find that word. For example, like a monk is a Christian word. And I remember asking some Catholics when we first came here, is it okay to use the word monk for us? They said, well, you know, what do you do? They said, we're celibate, we don't have any money. I said, great, if you're celibate and have poverty, then you're a monk, not a priest. But even now, that some people call, like, monks reverend or venerable, and which is actually the right word. But anyway, the monk is okay, because, you know, we are celibate and we're poverty, and that actually fits the meaning of the English word monk. Yeah, it's another word for God. It just means like a lord or a holy one, like a very high being. Yes, that's right, yes. Okay, no, you've got me again there on Christianity. Maybe take that question next door and you can ask them over there. They will know the answer. Okay, explain the term stream winner, non-returner. That's coming tomorrow. Did you say that the demon image you saw was a nimitta? I thought, or did you say that demon image you saw was a nimitta? I thought. I thought that all nimittas are only good images. Sometimes a nimitta, you know, these are the complicated nimittas, not the real useful nimittas, when you have scenery or images. You can have a scenery of all sorts of things. But when that demon came up, I knew it was like a creation of the mind. Sometimes you can make it into a good, you can make it into bad, it just depends what you add on to it. Sometimes these things can be scary. They're not really scary, it's just your reaction to them. And this is why that demon looked a bit scary, but I knew what to do with it. So there was a limiter, but a complex one and not a very useful one. How about sensing people's shape, not seeing form? What's this? Sensing people's shapes. Or feeling touch on the skin, or in the mind, a bit of chanting, etc. I think that, I'm not quite sure exactly what you mean there, but sometimes when the mind starts to get still, you know, the body becomes very sensitive, and that you can feel the body being very numb or very stiff or prickly or tingly, which is a common sign that the body is about to disappear. You can't call this a nimitta, it's just a stage in meditation when the body is becoming still and it's about to disappear. You perceive it in all sorts of different ways. So if it's you sense chanting in your mind, it's just probably just, again, this really is imagination. It's not useful to use chanting as a doorway into the jhanas, because it's too complicated. The best thing to do is leave all that stuff alone, keep it simple, watch the breath, beautiful breath, nimitta, don't try and find some shortcut. Because whenever anyone takes me on a shortcut, whenever I'm going, we always get lost. And it always takes much longer when you go the shortcut. When I'm in Singapore, or you know, even here in Perth, people always say, oh, I know the shortcut. And it takes hours by the shortcut. How about sensing... Oh, that's right, don't know why. Next question. What is the reason for celibacy being a cornerstone for most spiritual practices, apart from the fact that one does not have the burden of supporting and living with a partner? Yeah, I mean, you know what it's like living with a partner. Gee. Okay, the reason for celibacy is simply because the sexual urge, when you're celibate, you're putting that aside. And so that sexual urge is not part of the desires which you're encouraging. Because it's not a case that, okay, you have a bit of sex and you forget about it. It becomes like a habit. It's a place where the mind looks for its happiness and joy. And it's very, very complicated. You know, it's emotionally as well. And instead of having the sexuality, all that energy can go somewhere else, and that particular desire is not fed, and after a while, it just disappears. Just in the same way that if you don't use it, you lose it. If you don't keep encouraging that part of your mind, it just basically turns off. And so there's one less thing you have to worry about. It's great being like a monk who's been a monk for long enough that it means you can have a beautiful girl sitting in front of you and you don't treat her as a sex object. And she can come and tell you her problems and you know, you're not looking at her as a beautiful girl or an attractive girl. She's just a person. You treat her exactly the same way as if you were, and I mean this, as if you were speaking to an old man. So the sexuality, the youth or whatever else, is not part of the way you look at somebody. And I know that some women have told me it's such a relief actually to be able to speak to a man and not be treated as something sexual or a possible partner for the future. It completely changes the dynamic of the interchange. And so as a monk you can do that. And sometimes the women appreciate that, they've told me. Because at last, they don't feel that they have to protect their sexuality or promote their sexuality and all that complicated sort of sex business or relationship business or possible partner business is all sort of removed. And that's why many people or many ladies like speaking to monks. It's a man who is outside of that game. So it really helps being celibate. But more than that, it means that you're free of many, many burdens. So that's actually why you know, the Buddha was celibate and why he said the monastics, the monks and the nuns should be celibate. But if you can't handle the celibacy, you can always just leave. But as monks and nuns, celibacy. But later on, tomorrow, I'll explain that when you get to a certain stage in your meditation, in your enlightenment, non-returner, you can't have any sex anymore. That's one of the signs of enlightenment. Just that sexual urge is completely gone. That's another sign, if you're enlightened. If you're enlightened and can have sex, you're not enlightened. I'll mention that tomorrow. But don't worry that, I don't want to become enlightened, I like my sex. Don't worry, because it's much better than sex, being enlightened. So don't lose anything, you gain a lot. Yeah.
I know the answer to the thing about the Virgin Mary.
The Virgin Mary?
Yeah.
Is it a joke?
Well,
if it's serious, no.
Yeah.
But if it's a joke,
well,
yes.
It's sort of
a joke.
Yeah.
What is it?
Well, Italy wasn't unified until the 19th century. So it was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And Garibaldi unified all the nation states of Italy because it was broken up. Mm-hmm. And the Vatican, because Rome itself is actually, the Vatican is actually a separate state in Italy, and its power was threatened. So what they did in 1851, because there were revolutions right throughout Europe in 1848, is that they thought, we will take Mary and we'll put her in heaven, and she'll be up there with Jesus, and that will unify everybody, and it didn't work. So when do you think powerful infallibility was established? In about 1870. The Pope has never always been infallible. It's a political decision to stop the spread of liberalism and stop the spread of freedom through the nations, for the principalities of Italy in the 19th century. So that's where it comes from.
Okay, very good. I never knew that. Next question. For what you said, I understand that a layperson containing nirvana. Will he, she then give up all day-to-day responsibilities and lead a monastic lifestyle? Yeah, if it's full enlightenment, yes, that's what they'll do. But again, that's an enlightenment question for tomorrow. Last question for this evening, before you go to sleep. Some of you are already going to sleep. So I better finish so quickly. Here we go. Does one get protected and also gain much merit by chanting Pirit? That's Paritta chants, and the standards both morning and evening. You've heard me chanting for so long now. My chanting is very, very effective to protect you from ghosts. Monks are just so good, especially myself. My chanting is so powerful. As soon as a ghost hears it, it says, "Ah!" It sounds so terrible that no self-respecting ghost will stay to listen to it. I used to make that joke, that's why. Because some of the old monks are terrible at chanting. And that's why we're good ghost chants, because we scare the ghosts away. Even the ghosts get scared the way we chant. Especially if it's off key. But, do you get protected? The only way you get protected is not by the chanting, but by your precepts and by your virtue. That's the best protection you can possibly have. Because sometimes we like the easy way of just getting someone else to chant for us. And if it really worked and people got protected, you know, that why can't we get all these monks actually to chant over the soldiers so they never get blown up by the tigers or they never actually get killed by these bullets? So does it really work, all this chanting? Of course it doesn't. So some of it does work, but sort of chanting to protect you from bad things happening to you. The best thing, sorry?
Sorry, it was your own fear that you're avoiding something, the night, the dark, so you chant and you prevent that, that's all.
Yeah, it can be that, yeah, some of your fears. But sometimes the chanting works. Remember that story of, what was that nun's name? The one who got almost eaten by the bear? Tanasanti, yeah. Because her story was that when she was still a layperson, she was with her boyfriend trekking through the Himalayas somewhere, and they found this beautiful cave. And being stupid Westerners and not knowing exactly what a cave really means, sort of she meditated in front of the cave and her boyfriend meditated on the rock just above the cave. See, again, men always get higher, but they had actually more sense by being a little bit higher this time, because that cave was owned by somebody, like a bear. And when that bear came home and saw someone sitting outside of its cave, that bear was not a happy bear. And so that bear attacked her. And it grabbed her head in its jaws and was about to crush her skull. I remember her telling me the stories. She said, I didn't feel any pain. But what I did feel was nausea, because bears have terrible bad breath. They don't brush their teeth. So that's the worst thing about being eaten by a bear. Ugh, yucky. And not knowing what to do, she did some chanting. As soon as she started chanting, the bear let go and ran off. Her chanting must have been worse than mine. But at least it worked, and so she managed to get away. I must admit, I'm a bit of a cynic, because I always remember this movie when I was young. It was a horror movie. I used to go to watch these horror movies, you know, in the cinemas. And in this horror movie, this sort of devil or this demon, this really bad, evil person, was chasing this woman. And this woman managed to find two sticks. And she put the two sticks together as a cross. Protection! And this devil just swept it away and said, I don't believe in that rubbish, and carried on chasing her. Well, I thought that was very funny. I always remember that. So even demons don't believe in chanting anymore. So they're more refined these days. So they're not. So these superstitious demons will be kept away by the chanting. I don't know. I'm just making it up. But no, the point is, sometimes again, chanting will give you confidence. So that's very good. It makes you feel good. It gives you something to do to take your mind off being afraid. But I don't know really how often that does truly work to protect you against the bad things. The best thing is just to have a good mind state, keep virtue, keep peaceful, keep wise. And that's better than the chanting. Because originally the only chanting the Buddha did was actually had meaning. It was just to keep the teachings in mind. It was just like an actor learning Shakespeare, so he'd actually know what it meant, so he could perform it properly. So the chanting originally wasn't meant to have any sort of magical powers. It's only later on it came to have some magical powers. So anyway, that's what happens. So it won't protect you too much. So what protects you is your virtue, your own good karma, and your wisdom. Okay. Well, that's actually not true. Because again, that you read the Vinaya yourself, and you can have bhikkhunis. There's nothing which is actually stopping the ordination of bhikkhunis except the politics amongst the very senior monks. And also, is the duties of a bhikkhuni, which are very, very tough. So it's one of the reasons why the problem is, you know, it's a red herring to think, oh, you can't have bhikkhunis because there's no way of ordaining them these days. They can be ordained. You know, the monks can ordain nuns as bhikkhunis. You don't have to have a bhikkhuni sangha. That was pointed out to me, and it's a logical argument. You can do that. But anyway, there are bhikkhunis now. So you can have bhikkhunis and the bhikkhus ordaining the bhikkhunis. So it's very simple, can be done, has been done. There is a bhikkhuni lineage now. But that's not the main point. The main point is, if you look at some of the rules which the bhikkhunis have, they're so tough. The Buddha laid down those rules. And so if you are a bhikkhuni, that's what a bhikkhuni means. A bhikkhuni is not a person who has some status. It's a bhikkhuni is a person who is committed to keeping those rules in the bhikkhuni patimokkha. And one of those rules is you can't stay in a forest monastery. Because at the time of the Buddha it was just too dangerous, and too many bhikkhunis were getting into being violated. So how to stay in a city monastery where you got more protection. And even when we first got Dharmasala, this was before Sister Wayama came, quite a few of the people, it was not just the men, were really concerned, should we actually have some alarm system in case some scallywags come and want to rape Sister Wayama? And a lot of people were afraid of that. I don't know what it is, but sometimes when you say a nun, people think, well, they haven't got any protector, they're no husband, so they're fair game for weird, deviant people. Because of that, this obviously never happened at Dharmasala, thank goodness. Maybe now it's okay because there's enough of you that you know that it's in the numbers there's more safety. But certainly at the time of the Buddha was so concerned, he said, no, no forest for you, stay in the city. And even when you travel, you have to go with somebody else. You can't sort of go by yourself anywhere. And some of those rules are so tough that if you read them, you wonder, do you really want to become a bhikkhuni? And what we've been doing here in Perth, what I think is a possible alternative, but basically it's not up to me, it's up to what the women want to do. I'm not going to be patronizing and sort of tell women what to do, just make it all possibilities open for the nuns. Whatever they want to do, I'll support it. But personally, that I'm leaning towards having the 10 preceptors like we have now, but calling them nuns, who we call monks. And so when people don't go into the nitty-gritty of the precepts, of what precept you're supposed to keep and not keep, they actually, most people in Perth, they look upon the nuns and the monks as mirror images of each other. They don't have any idea of like bhikkhuni ordination or 10 precept ordination or whatever. And I've been mentioning that to Sister Wayama a long time ago. The 10 precepts is actually what separate you from being a homeless one, a samana, and being a layperson. Because the 10th precept is no money. And I wish all the monks had kept those 10 precepts. There's only very few monks keep 10 precepts. So you know, these nuns we have over here, they keep much better precepts than most monks. So the point is that if you have those 10 precepts and you can have the other rules, you can actually add the rules which you know are similar to the monks if you want, those ones which you know have got past their use-by date, you know, such as not being allowed to stay in a forest, you don't have to keep those. You've got more freedom by having those 10 precepts than you have by having the full set of bhikkhuni precepts. And basically the respect is not gained by having precepts. The respect is gained by what you do, how you behave, how you conduct yourself. And that, you know, is being won by the nuns at Dharmasala now. They are respected. So I can see that this particular model is probably less problematical than having bhikkhuni ordination. And many of the monks, because you know, we really try hard to keep our rules. And if there's a rule there, you know, we have to try and keep it. And sometimes you think a nun, like Bhikkhuni Kusuma, she's travelling by herself. And that's against the Bhikkhuni precepts. So that must be tough for her, because she probably knows that. But she can't keep it because it's not practical, but it's supposed to keep it. And that's a great difficulty. It's not a small rule as well, it's a big rule, Sangadi Seza rule. So these are rules there which, you know, are tough for nuns. I don't know what the solution is, but I'm leaning towards the fact of having just the 10 preceptors and people giving them the respect, not because they're bhikkhunis, but call them nuns, we're monks, use the English word. And then the status is there because the lay community give it to you. You are respected, and you feel respected. Hopefully that's the case anyway. So it's not just a simple question of, is it allowed or is it not allowed? If it was that easy, then there'd be no difficulty at all. It's the bhikkhuni precepts, they're very tough. And sometimes I noted that if you do take that higher ordination, you're actually much lower than you are now in the status. because the bhikkhuni precepts sometimes actually push the status down. Check it out, have a look at them. It's a very difficult issue. Yes?
One of your questions was responding to earlier about the nun's wise philosophy.
Yes, yeah.
And your response was that the narrative.
Yeah.
Could you foresee something in the future, say there would be turnover of the
nuns? Yeah, yeah. And if I sort of left and go somewhere else.
Would you see them then being separate?
Certainly, yes. And certainly that I've tried to, I don't think. If this has happened, I've tried to actually to encourage this. And on record, you can be taped here. If I go to Dharamsala Monastery, then I would hope that Sister Wayam and the other nuns would have the courage to take their food first, and then I'll take it afterwards, because it's their place. Would you do that, please?
I taught almost from Virginia, whatever. The monks are actually more senior than the nuns.
If you were bhikkhunis, yes. But 10 preceptors, you're in like a no man's land. Well, again, that's another thing, because you know, when Sister Wayama sort of became the abbot of the monastery at Dharamsala, and we had the first ordinations, she wanted me to also join in the ordination ceremonies. But I said, no, you do it, to give you more authority. But she didn't really feel confident enough yet to do it by herself. So, and she also wanted sort of me to have a stamp of approval, as if, you know, you've been ordained by both, and therefore that if you go somewhere else, you're more accepted. So I think that was her reasoning. But there's no reason why she can't just ordain you herself. And you know, so she's like full sort of teacher, instead of like a co-teacher. So it'd be great to be able to do that. Yeah?
Because, for example, you are a teacher, and then internally, like you are also Sister Wayama teacher and other non teacher, the same like in many places. Like, if you are a teacher, it's not because that you are in your mind, like that, but the respect to the teacher is to be humble, you know, like, I think when it's okay that women or men are talking about like equality and all sorts of things like that, but that is a worldly thing. Like, I can understand that women want it to be equal to men and all sorts of things like that. That's the worldly thing, but there's also something about like that. Being humble, if you are, even with monk, for example, people are humble, isn't it, in charge, like that, they watch his feet and all sorts of things like that, not because of, what you call, like, not because of the tradition, because of the respect that they have, they want to do it.
But it's great, actually, for monks to have humility as well. And so, you know, every now and again, I do meet someone who's senior to me. In the last time, it was Ajahn Ari Asiko, and I was visiting him in his monastery. He's disrobed now, unfortunately, but he was about a year senior to me. There's only the two of us, and after the meal, I said, I'm going to wash your bowl. He said, no, you don't need to do that. You know, we've both sort of been monks for almost 30 years. But I grabbed it before he could stop me. And I enjoyed that. I was actually doing a service to someone. It's just so nice to be able to do that if you're a very senior monk. You know, so you're not always out front. The senior monks love it when they're at the end of the line every now and again. So it'd be wonderful if I went to Dharamsala and just, Sister Wayama did all the chanting and stuff, and I just was at the end of the line and just could be nice and quiet for a change. Oh, it would just be heaven for me. She'd give all the talks and everything else. But it's also, it's making a statement there that at least like in Dharamsala, it's a nun's place. So, you know, you run the place and I'm your guest. And as a guest, you know, you take your food first and I'll take it afterwards. Now, it's no vinaya there because the food will get offered afterwards. There's no problem there at all. But in a monk's monastery, it's a monk's place, so the monks will go first.
Just mentioned that all the guests at Dharamsala, if they are more senior, they all go before, even before us or after the effort.
Yeah, it doesn't matter because I think that it's a nice thing to do. it's your place and it's for women, so that, you know, you feel it is your place and we can take afterwards. I went to one place in, I think they did that at Ratbury Monastery, that was the Gorsun Lurag, a very great nun. And I think the nuns got all served first, the monks would help themselves afterwards, or separately anyway. But they weren't first, because it was a nun's place. And all the men, all males had to be out by sundown. So, you know, we get kicked out. It's great to have things like that. Because, I mean, this is a Western place, and to get inspiration, to get growth of Buddhism and the Sangha here, you have to make some of those little changes. And it's good to do that. So, little by little, you know, I'm trying to sort of get Sister Wives to do more things. But, you know, she sometimes feels a bit sort of oppressed because it's tough work to give more talks, to even go on arms round, like the monks go on arms round on a Saturday morning. Little things like that. So that it is actually, the goal is that sort of the head nun at Dhammasara is looked upon as being a mirror image of the head monk at Bodhinyana. Sort of similar situation, similar facilities, similar duties and responsibilities as well. And I thought that would be achieved by just not calling you Bhikkhuni or Siladhara, but calling you nun, calling us monks. And people understand, like a nun is the female equivalent of a monk is the male equivalent of a nun. And getting the same respect, doing the same duties. And that way I think we both get the same respect. In the end anyway, it does not matter whether you're a male or a female, whether you're an old monk or a young monk, whether you're Sri Lankan or Australian. If you give a good talk, people want to listen. If you're practicing well, they respect you. And in the last analysis, that's what it is. Your practice earns you respect. So if you really become really great nuns, then you're really doing the very, very best to establish the female monastic tradition. Put aside the ordinations and all this external stuff. If you all become arahats, then the nun sangha will sort of flourish.
Ajahn, it's very inspiring to go to the nun monastery.
Yeah.
They really practice very well.
Yeah. Yeah. And someone told me the food there is much better than the monk's monastery.
Yeah. Fear that in Sri Lanka the places, if the ladies are given a place, then they will go and then the male monks might have a best place in the country.
Yeah, but look, there's plenty of monasteries.
But in places like Taiwan, there are more female nuns than...
Yeah, there's plenty of opportunities for males to become monks in Taiwan. It doesn't really matter, just because in the end, the whole idea of being a monastic is that celibacy, you're not a monk, you're not a nun, you're not a male, you're not a female anymore, you're a monastic. But obviously you do need the separation of the genders, otherwise people sort of, the tongues wag if you're in the same monastery. I don't care. If there's many nuns, but they're really good nuns, they give really good talks, they're good teachers. You know, basically you don't care who's up sitting here giving a talk, because obviously it's a good talk, and they teach, you know, deep meditation, they teach wisdom. Then you don't care whether it's a woman or a man. You just want to come to that retreat. You want to hear that Dhamma talk. And that's actually the best part of it. You know, so, you know, in Sri Lanka they hold fans in front of their heads. That's so you can't see the person giving the talk. So you can actually just hear the words. So you don't actually know it's a man or a woman behind there. Oh yeah, okay. Oh, I know some of these women sort of, they're speaking. And some of the men. Okay, yeah, go on.
I saw the video of the conference at the Buddhist conference.
Oh, yeah.
There's one segment about women in Buddhism.
Yeah.
I think there were four speakers. Each speaker, the nuns, they were nuns, except for Vicky, the head.
Yeah.
They were all very adamant that this discrimination against women in the Buddhist order does exist. And I came away with a very depressed feeling that it is true about hearing what they say.
Yeah.
And I think the only one who was balanced was Vicky.
Yeah.
She seemed to say that women have the ability to rise above this.
oppression or whatever, you know. Whereas the others, the nuns said that this has been established very deeply ingrained in society. And nuns can't, well, you know, are always going to be lower.
Yeah, it's an old Asian tradition. Because, you know, many Asian traditions that the wife is lower than the husband. No, and it just reflects the whole society there. Whereas in Chinese tradition, the wife's supposed to walk four paces behind the bloke or whatever. And so, because of that, it's just reflected in Asian culture. And so it's great because Asian culture is changing. You know, Singapore has changed enormously. Thailand has changed enormously. Sri Lanka has still got to change. Hasn't changed that much, but it's changing. And
Sri Lanka, the wife goes behind, protect the wife. Protect the wife.
Okay. There's all sorts of reasons. But anyway. But because the cultures are changing, that will change too. And so you have to make it happen. And as a Westerner, we were oppressed in Buddhism as well. When you first went to Thailand as a Western monk, you weren't taken seriously. You were just like a weirdo. You know, so a nice person to have in the monastery because of being more lay people into gawk. You're like a freak. And very much that's what you were the first times in Thailand. And it was only Ajahn Chah had many monks. He actually, you know, thought the Westerners had a chance to do something. And so he really taught them. And he did treat them equally. Which was actually one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah had so many Western disciples. And when you came here to Australia as a monk, again, you were a freak again. Because no one knew what a monk was. You had to make your place in society. You weren't given respect when you first came to Australia. In fact, quite the opposite. So this is 23 or 24 years now we've been here in Perth, and now we've earned that respect. You know, just throughout the whole nation, and not just with Buddhists. And so, instead of complaining, oh, we've got no respect, there's oppression. Now obviously the men can do something, but the biggest onus is on the women, to actually to earn that respect. To go out and be nuns, and make it as a nun. And just get that respect. Be great teachers. And go and sort of write the books or go and give talks and be inspirations like you're becoming. And that way that you are making the nuns' sangha alive and showing that oppression is not there anymore. But I can't do that. All I can do is just give you freedom. All other monks can do is just to bat out and just support. If you support too much, then it's again just the monks are just getting involved and just doing it for you. It's too patronizing.
Krishna always said that the ladies in Sri Lanka are unable to go to any pilgrimage to study Pali or study Buddhism.
Oh, they're very lucky. Because too much study and you don't become a good nun. But I see your point there, yeah. So the opportunity should be made available, made open. So the monk shouldn't stand in the way. So the monk should get out of the way and give that freedom, that opportunity. But in the end, it's up to the women to take that freedom and grasp it.
As a monk in Sri Lanka, anybody can study Pali in the
university. Yeah. Yeah. It's good, yeah, but sometimes it may be easier for a laywoman to study Pali than for a nun to study Pali. Is that the case?
Yes, the university, yes.
Yeah. So that's a bit weird.
I think that's so. I know that it's very but there was one different point. It's not only Asian society that women are students of faith. Even Western society, it's not like they just start to ask for women's life recently. Because I remember that university, I started women's movement, and I can see a lot of women oppressed, you know, what Western society, some of them, I mean, I don't want to go into detail, but even in religion, even nowadays, there's still an argument in like women not allowed to be at the shop, not ordinary. And I thinking that was, it's not like a revolution, it's like, what you call, like a reform.
Mm.
And I'm thinking that, I mean, like, although women have been oppressed before, then, when you are slowly, you know, like, as you say, from their own practice, they gain respect. The same as, like, some of the women movement that have not been successful because people don't respect it. But in some movement, they have been very successful because they gain.
That's the same as the gay movement as well. The homosexual and lesbian movement have gained respect because of gained momentum because they're respectable people. This is actually how it works. And then you do get some equity in the what you receive and the services you get. So it's happening. So instead of complaining about darkness, you should always light a candle. So very often we complain and say, oh, it's not right, we shouldn't do this. And one of the criticisms of that nuns movement is they have many conferences and they talk a lot, but what are they doing? And one of the things over here in Perth, at least we've done something. We've got a Dhamma Sabha, we've got a nuns monastery, we've got something. We've done something, and thanks to these nuns there. So once you do something, it's much better than complaining, oh, we shouldn't have oppression, we shouldn't do this. I mean, you need sort of more really strong, courageous pioneers to make it happen. That's the best thing.
I said, this out of curiosity, there was a nun from Canberra. She participated in the conference.
Yeah.
She seems to speak with an American accent or Australian accent, but
who's that?
I couldn't miss out whether she was Australian.
Oh, Chi Kwang. Yeah, she's from Victoria, Chi Kwang.
Is she Australian born?
Yeah, Australian born, yeah, Chi Kwang. She's a very good friend. It's great, actually, that, you know, being a Theravada monk, you know, that you can get on so well with all the different sort of different types of Buddhism, the different genders in Buddhism, and it's great to have that sort of friendship across the genders and across the different sects. Because being a celibate, I don't believe in sects. S-E-X or S-E-C-T-S. So that way you can embrace everybody, the good people. Okay, so I think that already someone's sort of nicked off back to bed because it is late. We're supposed to be talking about meditation. When you become enlightened, there's no discrimination, no distinction anymore. In the unity of the jhanas, there is no male or female because the mind has got no gender. Even in Pali, chittang is neuter gender. So the mind is beyond gender. And that's also that people who go to the jhana realms, all the gender stuff, male or female, lasts up to the Brahma realm in the Devaloka. Above the Brahma realm, in other words, the jhana realms, there's no more gender. That's where gender finishes. So are you a female? Or are you just a neuter mind in a female body? It's obviously right, because that's why you can get reborn from male body to female body, female into a male. Because the mind is neither. So that's why we should transcend it by getting into jhanas. Then there's no more nuns, there's no more monks, there's no more lay people, there's just arahats in the Redemptorist Monastery in North Perth. So may that be the case. Good night. Wow, that was a tough one.